And the verses go like this. The serpent was clever, more clever than any wild animal God had made. He spoke to the woman, "Do I understand that God told you not to eat from any tree in the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "Not at all. We can eat from all the trees in the garden. It's only about the tree in the middle of the garden that God said, don't eat it. Don't even touch it or you'll die." The serpent said to the woman, "You won't die. God knows that at the moment that you eat from that tree, you will see what's really going on. You'll be just like God, knowing everything ranging from the way from good to evil, ranging all the way from good to evil." When the woman saw that the tree looked like good eating and realized that what she would get out of it, she'd know everything. She took the fruit and ate it, and then gave some to her husband, and he ate it. Immediately, the two of them did really see what was going on. They saw themselves naked, so they sewed fig leaves together as a makeshift clothing for themselves. When they heard the sound of God strolling in the garden in the evening breeze, the man and his wife hid in the trees of the garden. They were hiding from God. God called to the man, "Where are you?" He said, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid." God said, "Who told you you were naked? Did you eat from the tree I told you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you gave me as a companion, she gave me fruit from the tree, and yes, I ate it." God said to the woman, "What is it that you have done?" She replied, "The serpent seduced me, and I ate."
I should probably offer a sentence or two of disclosure. For those of you who know when Lent really begins, it doesn't begin today. But we had wanted to work on the seven deadly sins through this Lenten season, and since there are seven deadly sins and Lent is six Sundays, we needed to push it forward a week. And then I got thinking, probably it would be worth setting up and getting started before that. And so here we are about a week and a half in front of the Lenten season talking about Lent. But that's the reason why. I would like to begin with a parable. This is not a Jesus parable, though it could have been because it's a good one. Here it is. There was an old man who was teaching his grandson about life. "A fight is going on inside me," he said to the boy. "It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One wolf is evil. He has anger and envy and sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, lies, self-pride, superiority, self-doubt, and ego. The other wolf is good. He is joy and peace and love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." He said to the boy, "The same fight is going on inside you and inside every other person too." And the grandson thought about it for a minute, and then he asked his grandfather, "Which wolf will win?" And the grandfather simply replied, "The one you feed." We find other lists like this in the Bible. This parable has them too, a listing of both the good and the bad. But it does not use the word sin, which I suppose we might excuse since this parable is a parable of the Cherokee tribe and not from our Bible. But we do have a Bible story, a more familiar one that was just read for us, about a man and a woman and also a wise old talking snake with legs that begins to talk and begins to point out the options of life. And though God is also in the story, God does seem to be a silent partner in the background while the snake is doing most of the talking, pointing out the differences between the trees, pointing out the options that make for life and the options that make for death, pointing out what is most delightful and what is most wise. The options, pointing out the choices. And in the end, the man and the woman began to notice things in a way that they have never noticed them before, that they had choices to make, which was new, but something also began to happen, that after making their choices, they saw the need to cover themselves with a cover-up shield of both shame and blame. Never once does this ancient story in our Bible ever use the word sin. And maybe that is as good a place as any for us to begin. For though the word sin does not appear, the ancient Bible story with a talking snake with legs is trying to tell us something, maybe more than one thing. Maybe this reading is kind of like a parable. I will never forget the day or the question. It was nearly 25 years ago on Candidate Sunday back at our home church at Lakeview at a congregational meeting very similar to Dustin sitting with us all a few weeks back, a get-to-know-you question and answer session. And a woman asked me, "Will you be able to name sin?" And this was a woman I knew very well, and I sensed that she was nervous about something in particular. And I said to her privately afterwards, "Sin is a comprehensive word that might get more personal than you might think." Now, this woman was of the plucky and thoughtful type, and it was after we had finished our series on the seven deadly sins that she came back to me later and said, "Well, now I know what my besetting sin is. I have a name for it. The one putting up the biggest fight in me is gluttony," her own wolf fight, as it were. Let me pose two biggies, since next week we're about to dive into the deep end of the Lenten pool. Let me ask two biggies right off the bat. One, do you consider yourself a righteous person? Why or why not? That's a question worthy of some sit-down time. And righteous, is that something that you can answer for yourself? Is it possible to self-designate oneself as righteous? Is self-righteousness a thing? Has anyone ever called you you're a righteous person? And if they did you own it? Or would you somehow humble it or fumble it away? Do you consider yourself a righteous person? That's one biggie. And the second biggie is this. Is the word sin a helpful one? Sin is a church word. I don't hear it being spoken of down at the Franklin Farm Store. At Lowe's, I do not hear it being talked about at Quick Clips or the Olive Garden or walks through our neighborhood. Sin is a church word. What would happen if the church dropped sin from its vocabulary? Is sin a worn-out word? Would another word do in its place? The ancient talking and walking snake story may not use the word sin, but there's a something going on. What is the something? Am I involved in something, and how does my involvement in that something affect me, and not just me, but also the people around me? So yeah, the second biggie. Is the word sin a helpful one or not? This feels more like a commercial break to me, but I want to offer my opinion. I think Bible stories like the one in Genesis 3 about a snake with legs that talks has been terribly misused at times. One afternoon up north, I got to talking with my neighbor across the lawn, and as a professing Christian, he was happy to hear what his neighbor, the pastor, might have to say on some matters of church, and we were having a most pleasant conversation, but then Miss Connie came walking towards us across the yard, and he quickly excused himself from our conversation by saying, "I cannot discuss things with a woman around. Women are easily deceived. Says so in the Garden of Eden story. Eve was the first to be snookered. Women are to blame." And for nearly two millennia, women have been pushed to the margins of church because of this thinking, Can we just say once and for all that it is crappy theology? That's my opinion. And I think this ancient talking snake story has also been pushed, shoved, and compressed, vacuum sealed into an early church doctrine that maybe sin wasn't just Eve's fault, and maybe Adam was no saint either, but sin originated there in the garden with them both. Sin originated there and is somehow passed on from one person to the next. And since the great St. Augustine had been kind of a playboy in his earlier life, a man about town, a dude, a swinger, he thought that original sin must be passed down through conception and childbirth. That sin is passed down through the generations as it is through transmitted by sex. And we might think that that is silly talk, and I would say it certainly is. This doctrine of original sin lingers long in our churches. And did I mention the word sin does not appear in this snake story from the garden? What I'm after is, can we see what happens when we push the story to push the blame back on someone? Whether it's on Eve, whether we're blaming the snake, whether we're blaming the devil. Push the blame. Can we see what happens when we use this ancient story to do a theological research project? Searching out the cause and effect of sin. Adam and Eve were the cause. We are the effect. It has been passed down to us. An ancient story like this one is not meant to be a blame it on someone story. It is not meant to get funding to do a theological research grant into original causes. This ancient story is meant to be more of a mirror, a parable of the way it is with us humans and our choices all over the globe, throughout all history, inside churches and outside of them. This story is a biblical selfie shot. This is who we are. This is what goes on with us, with all of us. We all have a case of the wolves. That was my opinion. A couple of stories. There was the day me and my best buddy, Kenny C., decided not to take school bus number 5 home after our day in sixth grade was over, but instead decided to walk around town a bit. I was quite intrigued with a place that had sidewalks and straight paved streets lined with maples. I mean, when you live on a hilly, mile and a half, dusty dirt road, the town like New Milford looked so intriguing, so enchanting. So Kenny C. promised me a walk around town. And on Main Street, there was a store that held particular interest for all of us kids, Wittig's Five and Dime Store, a corner store with shelves of toys and candy and other such goodies, things you wouldn't see at home. So in through the doors of Wittig's Five and Dime we went, and after playing with some toy cars, Kenny C. said to me, "You want one?" And I said, "Sure." And so Kenny C. looked to see if old Mrs. Wittig was looking at us from behind her desk, then slipped two of the cars into his pocket, and out the door we went, and that was that. Up the street with our cars, nobody the wiser. It wasn't long before I noticed something was off. Something was wrong. For one, I wanted to keep my car in my pocket so that no one would know that I was in possession of a pilfered car. And when I did finally get home, I couldn't play with it in the open, as I had hoped. For sure, Mom would see it and ask her prying questions. So I played with it in my bedroom with the door closed. And yeah, suddenly the fig leaves in the snake story began to make sense. Fig leaves are for covering up, just like I was doing. And it felt like crap. I hated that feeling. And I don't know, what does it take for sin to be declared a sin? Does it take knowing better and then doing it anyway? Is one innocent if one is the beneficiary of a theft, when one did not actually pull the heist themselves? Can sin be guilty by association? Did the Houston Astros ever read this Bible story? Can sin affect the whole team? Can sin affect the whole team, or is sin only a matter of what resides in one's own heart and our choices? Lori is my sister-in-law, whom some of you got to meet when she spoke here about her sexual abuse. To say that her home life was a wreck is to put it mildly. There was so much fear, so many drunken rages, so much yelling, so much hitting and hiding and escaping from her dad and her brothers. After she married my brother Mike, she tells of the day their well pump went tilt. No water in the house. And so Mike asked my dad to come over and help him on a Saturday to fix it. And so they went to work at the wellhead, which was just situated outside their living room window. And they worked all morning, pulling up the well pump, making the repairs, working together, taping and splicing and putting it all back together. And as she watched them working out the living window, she just began to weep. Just weep uncontrollably. For it was one of the first times in her life that she knew something had been wrong, dreadfully wrong, all along, that the troubles in her growing up home were not normal. That a dad and a son could work on a project without yelling or cursing or calling each other dreadful names. That there was a power that did not come from a beater stick, or with the vocal forces of using one's goddamn words, or with other hellish threats coming from her dad, but that respect and care could be created with a power of its own. She saw it. Until then, she knew nothing different. When she saw the contrast, she began to weep. So yeah, what does make sin sin? Is it always something that you do wrong? Can it be something wrong that has been done to you? And you carry that wrong around you for half your life? Can sin be a force that breaks a family apart, a marriage apart, a team apart, a church apart? Were you able to watch the documentary by Pastor Phil that Monica sent our way? Can sin be a force that can even break a whole nation apart, like Germany, like the United States? What is this force, and does it have a name? Sometimes the word sin is something we can look up in thick books when we're writing a sermon. It is a dictionary word. You can find it. But sometimes we do not need our Bibles or our dictionaries to describe something is wrong, something hidden. Sometimes it tears. Sometimes it's tears that tell us, or a rage or fatigue that something is amiss. Sometimes we sense something in life that is more like the slow tug of a dragnet or a vacuous feeling. And what words should we use for those moments that we discover? Jesus did tell a parable of his own one day about a man who had two kids. And one kid was a bit of a scamp. No, truth be told, both kids were scamps. And the first kid was out doing the kinds of scampish things that scampish kids do. He did it for a good long while. Then in the middle of his scampishness, it says, the kid came around, saw the trouble, felt the troubles firsthand, and decided to return home and make amends. Which can be part of the sin process. Part of the sin process the righteous scamp kid still hadn't figured out. And at the end of Jesus' parable about the two scamp kids, we might ask our own questions. Is God mad, carrying a big stick, or is God really love? And is sin something God wants us to quit? And if sin is something God wants us to quit, which wolf will we feed? So yeah, beginning next Sunday, we will be going old school for a full 7 weeks, naming seven sins. Oh, there's more. There's more than seven. Plenty more that could be given their names, but it can be important to name those situations that we carry in our bodies and in our bones and unwittingly pass on to others and hurt them. According to those who were taking the early church selfie shots, there are seven of the most trickiest. Pride, envy, greed, anger, lust, sloth, gluttony. Seven of the trickiest. I would say that giving names to sin is sort of like this hibiscus plant that we brought in. Some of our work is to name the dead wood and to prune it. Lent comes in the spring, and we know what happens this time of year. How many of us have been pacing our orchards and our flower beds? This is the time of year when we look for things to be greening up. And maybe that is the best picture for us to carry along with us during these 7 weeks. For Lent is not meant to be a season of beatdowns. It is meant to be a season of repair, of greening up.
Hear these words from the book of Matthew. When Jesus saw his ministry drawing huge crowds, he climbed the hillside. Those who were apprenticed to him, the committed, they climbed the hill with him. Arriving at a quiet place, he sat down and taught his climbing companions, and this is what he said. You're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and his rule. You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you. Only then can you be embraced by the one who is most dear to you. You're blessed when you are content with just who you are, no more, no less. That's the moment you find yourselves proud owners of everything that can't be bought. You're blessed when you've worked up a good appetite for God. His food and drink is the best meal you'll ever eat. You're blessed when you care. At the moment of being careful, you find yourselves being cared for. You're blessed when you get your inside world, which is your mind and your heart, to put right. Then you can see God in the outside world. You're blessed when you can show people how to cooperate instead of compete and fight. That's when you discover who you really are and your place in God's family. You're blessed when your commitment to God provokes persecution. The persecution drives you deeper into God's kingdom. Not only that, count yourselves blessed every time people put you down or throw you out or speak lies about you to discredit you. What it means is that the truth is too close for comfort and they are uncomfortable. You can be glad when that happens. Give a cheer, even for though they don't like it, I do. And all of heaven applauds. And remember, know that you are in good company. My prophets and my witnesses have always gotten into this kind of trouble. Let me tell you why you are here. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out all of God's flavors of this earth.
This feels like a little bit of an add-on, but I wanted to say this as well. Beginning next Sunday and during the season of Lent, the preaching scheme will come off as a little different. The sermon time will come in a twofer format, two shorter sermons instead of one longer one. One short sermon used to sort of name a deadly sin, and one short sermon aimed more at the repair or a holy virtue. Sandwiched in between will be a time for other things, confession and prayer, words of assurance. There will be a middle section. We will also be hearing multiple voices. In an email that I had sent out earlier in the month, I called it a preaching party, but it was meant to gather more than one verse to speak with us, which is actually an old and odd part of our Anabaptist tradition, to realize that not any one person can know everything. No one person has it all. That we might benefit from hearing more than one voice, and so we will. Stay tuned.